course, every time the questions, we turn to the Golden Hut. Any questions at all? It's a little bit non-standard tonight. I didn't anticipate what would happen, so some of my comments may have been a little bit perhaps more liberal than normal, but I think each had its own value, and I'll allow Mark to erase the tape.
When was the first inspiration for the synthesizer?
About 1971, I think. I'd finished up at Oxford, and I went across to America to do a postdoc position, and it was to have been in solid-state physics, but in those days, you could really do what you like. And I started to... I left Oxford. I had Tahar, who was my mentor there, who got me interested in the solar system, and I just felt that, I really hadn't properly... really got to the bottom of many. You've got to write your thesis up in 3 years, and I hadn't really... I barely scratched the surface, and I felt unhappy. Well, I got my PhD out of it. I mean, I'd really... A lot of things have been swept under the rug. And when I got to America, I was a bit more relaxed than where I was in Pittsburgh, and a long way from Cornell there, fortunately. And I didn't realise those gangsters were operating then anyway. You know, when you're young, you're unaware of these low acts. It's only when you get a bit older that, you really find out what's happening out there. So that's why it's always, good to meet nice, honest people like the Space Association and people like Kate, for example, who plays the game cleanly. But she herself can testify to a number of perpetrations that have been done on her slide collection. Yes. And that, I don't know whether that fully answers your question, but I was sitting there at my terminal one night, and I realised that, there's got to be some way out of this problem of why the planets are so light. And I thought, Tahar had often said to me, you ought to think of adding turbulence into the model. So I sort of, at that stage, I didn't really have much of a physical model for it, but I did try a few little mathematical ones, and the one that seemed to work the best was type of gravitational potential, which I realised later would come from buoyancy, and with the hot air balloons and things. And so I modelled up what it would be and put it into the program, and sure enough, because the turbulent stress depends on buoyancy, which depends on gravity, is always greatest at the edge of the cloud where the mass is largest. It had the greatest effect there, and it actually would have a non-proportionate effect because the inner regions of the cloud, which were very, fairly dense, they would remain as they are, and the outer layers would get pushed right outwards. And the overall effect is that if you rescaled the density, the central regions would be even closer to the centre, and you had this effect of a central concentration. And I was just sitting there, I ran it through on the computer. I didn't think it would work out. And it was in about 2 a.m. one night. Suddenly, hey presto, I discovered this moment of inertia factor was drastically declining. And I realised then, really this was how it worked. And I also realised, and I've since appreciated the fact that this gravitational buoyancy works in all atmospheres, like our own atmosphere, and you could equally reapply it with Jupiter and Saturn and stuff like that. And people have said to me, why have supersonic turbulence when you could invoke many other things, and like magnetic forces? But it is true the Sun has magnetic forces, and even Jupiter has some, but when you go to the other planets, you never get the high enough temperatures to get ionization. So you needed a universal force, and it seemed to me gravity was the way to go, and it follows naturally from the model. But now, 20 years later, or more than that, I've got Chris Dyte working on the problem, and he has in fact confirmed this early idea. So I think it has to be a winner, because it seems to be doing the right thing. Oh, there are many other things to cover yet, but that's a rough idea. Now let me say, tonight's a prototype run for the ASV, because I know you've got some very refined members there. And there were some uncouthnesses that may have emerged tonight. I can't been some uncouthnesses. Yeah, but Helena seems happy, so that's all that counts.
Can you describe the process of planting
the
evolution? What are the processes that created the moods to the Jupiter? Are they a similar?
Yeah, everything's scaled down because the mass of Jupiter is very much less than Saturn again. You know, I never get to the same high temperatures. I didn't show the temperatures there. I have a slide which does that. But whereas the innermost planet of the solar system, Mercury, formed at 1600 degrees, probably little Io formed at about 500 Kelvin, and Mimas probably at about 240, something like that, and the Uranian moons barely get up to about 170. Everything is much colder. So you can work it all out, and I'm redoing the calculations at the moment for Jupiter. I've forgot a little bit of time up my sleeve because, I can concentrate on one planet at a time. I mean, I mentioned the Cassini mission, but that won't get to Saturn until 2004, so I've got a bit of time up my sleeve. In fact, the same period of time will elapse, I think, from now to then, as has elapsed between my lecture tonight and my previous one. But there is a risk I'll never ever be asked to speak again here. yes, and Russell had one too. You probably will.
It's just a very basic question. Could you give just a very brief comparison between the modern passing theory and the conventional theory?
Yes.
The conventional theory, I believe, is something like a catching model.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, my theory produces planetesimals from the gas rings, those little grains, but the gas rings model confines them into well-defined tori, where the accretion then takes place around the torus. With the disk model, everything's spread out in a plane, and it's a complete rumpus just to work out where would a planet form? How can it know where to form? There's stuff everywhere, and that's never really been properly explained. George Weatherall, works for the Carnegie Institute. He's done some calculations for the inner solar system and claims to have got reasonable numbers. But the timescales then to produce Neptune and Uranus are hundreds of millions of years. In fact, Neptune shouldn't have formed at all, according to his model. So there are got problems. And also he hadn't assumed Jupiter was there as well. And that makes a big difference. It turns out, you might have known this, of course, Mars is only about a tenth the mass of the Earth, and Venus is about 80%, 81. Why is there a little peak in the masses there, you see? I think Jupiter was responsible. Jupiter formed before Mars, just like I said, Neptune was the first formed planet. With the disk theory, so everything sort of forms pretty well at the same time, and so there are different outcomes from the model. With my model, Neptune forms Uranus, Saturn, Jupiter. And now I think Jupiter is so massive it would have frustrated the growth of Mars. It certainly stymied the asteroids. They never got to form at all. And Jupiter would have ejected a lot of the asteroids. The process of forming a planet probably was very inefficient because, you know, as I say, there probably were three or four Earth masses of material from which the Earth could have formed of its orbit. And I bet you a lot of that never got down onto the orbit. The Earth had to make do with as much as it could before the Sun flared up. And a lot of competing processes. If you look at the Saturnian system of moons, they're very light in comparison, and they taper off as you go inwards. But the rough distributions of mass seem to come out on the model, but one has to superimpose on it probably additional processes, but it's all a sort of top-down thing. I mean, what I was going to say is the pivot to the model is the supersonic turbulence, and then you build out from there. And so there's a sort of central pin, and then you build these other things. You have to take into account settling times of grains out of the gas and stuff like that, and the effect of convection due to the early sun. And these are phenomena that a lot of the early history of the solar system is gone, and you'll never be able to fully recover them. And that's why I think it's a great triumph that this model is able to recover the broad elements that are seen, like the chemistry. And I don't think the other models are doing that. And so that's, but that's you know, that's another chapter. Yeah. Did you have a question?
Yes. Are there any Oort clouds or objects in the stable, or is that just all too far?
Oh, there is the Oort cloud. One stage had a slide showing these little grains way out in the interstellar medium. And I think that most of them, there's a great flurry of comets at the beginning, and they all got to the centre of the sun, and then there were quite a few at the edge that were escaped accumulation, and they formed the present population of comets. And as the clouds spun out, you know, they're probably out there spinning around still, or just probably only a few percent of the original swarm. I think someone has estimated the mass of all the comets. It's quite small. There's not really a significant mass there. And you still, you know, they still come roaming in. But that's a whole separate study, comets. You know, there's a lot of stuff there we don't fully understand. And
is that part of a gas jet, the same as you were saying before?
Oh, I think that there's a general extended cloud, a halo, which is fairly spherical. And then there is a Kuiper belt about out at about 200 astronomical units, about 7 or 8 times the orbit of Neptune. It's believed to be a torus of comets, but no one's really said, that hasn't really been confirmed. A lot of these have been inferred by theoretical inference, just looking at the rates at which comets come in. I don't think anyone's seen a Kuiper belt. They've picked up this whole dozen objects beyond the orbit of Pluto. They're well known, but I don't think they're cometary bodies. I think they're actually remnants, and all of those objects that they've found are all prograde, whereas comets are equally retrograde as prograde, because they come from all directions. But that's another chapter in its own right. Is it so unraveling this problem is a bit like, you know, sort of sorting out a crossword or one of these. The Age, I think, now publishes things called code words. We're just given one letter, and you have to sort of reconstruct the rest of the alphabet. So if you can't get the first word, which my wife was unable to do last week, and certainly I was unable to, and even less still the cat, then you're really, really stuck. Not through lack of inquiry, I should add. Yes. Yes. And I should mention, I know Kate Doolan would be very interested in this with all her various very informative articles that she's written. Yes. And that should be worth a couple of free more copies. Yes. A few more slides. And so what we have here, there's another mission coming off the assembly line. And I just got a bulletin the other day, the Cassini messenger, I think it's its name, and it says that this spacecraft will be definitely launched in late 97 and will be inserted into orbit about Saturn on July the 1st, 2004. So that's about something like almost 10 years away, just under 10 years, 9 and a bit years. So that project's going ahead. And of course, you know, all of the discoveries that were made by Voyager, they will become superseded, I think, probably by this particular spacecraft. Thank you, Andrew. General listeners will be pleased to know that. So I've waffled on a fair bit there about the weaknesses of, you know, our limitations of our current technology and the danger of drawing inferences, which can be very misleading. I think the real thing is to sort of, within any given era or age, if you make certain measurements, that you have to sort of set certain goals as to what you can do with those. And for example, let's look at like this fellow here, it's a comet. Now, we're very lucky that we don't have to actually travel out and use large telescopes and chase or rocket ships to chase after comets, although that is being done. If we're sufficiently patient, comets will in fact show up at our own doorstep, and as indeed Halley did a few years ago. Last year, for example, we had this so-called comet crash, again, which was covered very well by Miss Doolin in the literature, in an educational manner, which was accessible to a large spectrum of the general public. And this is Kate published in Time magazine. This is actually the front cover of it. But it does show, right on our own doorstep, we have these items. Now, here's Duncan Steele very kindly lent me this one. He showed at his talk last year, the probability of being hit by a comet. It is actually quite low. It's down about 1 in 1,000,000 for any individual person, and it's really very unlikely that it'll happen. It's more likely that you'll get run down by a motor car, or someone will shoot you in the foot or something, or you'll electrocute yourself or something like that. Even botulism gets a Guernsey there. But swimming in the Monash pool is another main hazard that hasn't been put on there. But these, as you move up into this scale, you're getting into the region of rare events. Chances of being locked out of a major public meeting, for example, by an inconsiderate group. Not to mention the Omega group. But here, the listeners won't mind that this slide is upside down because they can't see it. But every now and then you do get a large impact. This was the Tunguska event. Later this year there's going to be the fifth, maybe only the third, international visit again to the Tunguska region to inspect the site, the impact site. And sure enough, there was a huge impact there back at the start of this century. I'm not sure whether... I think it was 1908. Is that correct? In June, thereabouts. And the large areas of forest were devastated. And they never actually found the impact object. It wasn't found to be buried, and it's now believed that it possibly was actually, rather than a comet, it may have actually been a very fragile meteorite that blew up in the air. And these things can happen, a sort of an airborne explosion. But had that Tunguska event impact occurred 3 hours later, and landed in the Atlantic Ocean, it would have produced a huge tidal wave that would have actually wreaked a huge amount of havoc across northern Europe, or at least America and in those neighbouring regions. But nonetheless, that did not happen, and for which we can be grateful. But it turns out there aren't really that many... You can't really blame the Almighty or... for being knocked out by a comet. I mean, the chances are pretty low. Occasionally, someone will get hit by a fragment. In fact, even then, there's only one known instance of there was some chap in Africa who got pinged on the back of the head. He thought someone had fired a pea shooter at him. It turned out he looked around and he found there was, in fact, he'd been struck by a fragment of a meteorite. But even then, it wasn't a full hit. Apparently it had bounced off a banana plant and it just sort of glanced him. So no, this bloke, far from being struck down, it was a secondary event. It may have even been a banana that got him. Being attacked by a... Yes. So really, I mean, there's been a lot of, people have been... A lot of bunkum about... I think Duncan was the chief proponent of this. How far does your transmitter extend? Anyway, a lot of people, got worried last year that, doomsday had arrived and got one of these comets. Fortunately, Jupiter does... This is true. Does sweep up a lot of this debris. It's like... I think Duncan called it a giant sort of vacuum cleaner. And this comet, instead of ploughing into the Earth, was sort of distracted by Jupiter.